Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. Two words, gang. Debt and limit. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, the 17th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I am pretty sure that what I'm about to say is the first use of the tortured kick the can down the road macroeconomic metaphor of the recent news cycle, but here we are. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy went to Wall Street today for a speech on the looming debt limit. More accurately, it's the debt limit that Congress blew past in January. We are now firmly in the land of extraordinary measures that have extended the deadline to June, or maybe July. It's a little bit vague. What's not vague at all is what a default would mean. And one can't help but cast one's mind back to 2011, the last time congressional Republicans brought the United States perilously close to defaulting on its debt, the financial effects of which lasted for years. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer gets us going on this Monday.
12 years ago, it seemed like defaulting on the U.S. debt might have actually been an option for some politicians. Laura Blessing, a senior fellow at Georgetown University, says 2011 was a turning point for world markets.
As they have woken up to the very real danger of us, you know, kind of juggling with hand grenades on this one.
In response, the credit rating agency Standard & Poor's downgraded U.S. creditworthiness from the highest rating, a AAA, to AA+. Now, you may be thinking, big deal, we still got an A. But in fiscal 2011, the U.S. paid about $1 billion more to borrow money, according to the Government Accountability Office. Susan Irving, a senior advisor at the GAO, says there's still a hangover.
I think where you see the lasting effect is in nervousness about the Treasury market.
Treasury bills, those IOUs the U.S. issues. Irving saw that lasting effect in 2013 when there was, again, a stalemate over raising or suspending the debt limit. Irving says nervous investors demanded a higher interest rate, and some just said, forget it.
And what we call bid to cover, the number of requests to buy compared to the amount you're selling, dropped.
The Bipartisan Policy Center says the 2011 and 2013 debt limit debates drove up the cost of government borrowing. And Rachel Snyderman, an economist at the center, says now that's happening again.
Because of the inherent risk that financial markets see surrounding a potential debt limit debate this summer.
Snyderman estimates if Congress doesn't raise or suspend the debt limit, the U.S. could run out of money to pay its bills by this summer or early fall. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Speaker McCarthy's speech today was fairly predictable, standard talking points. He did say this, though, when asked about how Wall Street might react the closer he takes the economy to the debt limit. Markets go up and down, the speaker said. And that is true. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. True story. Got an email from my tax person this weekend, and let's just say there is a balance due this year on the Rizdal family account at the Internal Revenue Service. We will get a check in the mail to them as soon as possible, but spare a thought for those who might prefer to pay up in cash. Not pennies or a truckload of dimes or single dollar bills to stick it to the tax man, but just currency, paper money, exact change, too. Jay Zagorski did that this year. He teaches at the Questrom School of Business at Boston University, and he is here to tell the tale. Jay, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Kai.
You wanted to pay your taxes in cash. My question, sir, is why?
Why? Well, first, Kai, I teach students about money, and I always ask them to look at the front of their bills. And on the front of the bills, it states, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. And income tax is one of our biggest public debts. And for years, I was wondering, was it even possible to pay in cash? Because I'd never heard of anyone who had paid in cash. And a couple of years ago, one of my students said, Professor, I actually found it on the IRS website.
Like instructions for how to pay in cash?
Instructions on the IRS website for how to pay in cash.
So you cannot simply walk into the local IRS office and hand them, you know, $452.97 and be done with it?
No, as a matter of fact, first you had to make an appointment. And the lady I talked to said that I was very lucky that there were some appointments in my local office here in Boston available before tax day, and that many of her other offices were booked all the way up to May. So that if I had waited a little bit longer, I couldn't pay in some other parts of the country in cash. After I made an appointment, I went down to the federal building. It took a little while to get in because yeah. There's pretty high security at the federal building.
Yeah.
And then I sat there, and after about 30 minutes, they came up and they apologized and they said, we cannot keep cash in this facility because it's not safe, which I found a little bit ironic given...
In the federal building.
Yeah, in the federal building and how much effort it took to actually get into the federal building. And they said they needed to schedule a courier. I showed up a week later, and it took about 30 minutes for them to accept my cash, and they filled in what appeared to be a four-part carbon form. So the IRS has not yet automated this part of their business. And let me say, Kai, I was not trying to be a pain in any way, shape, or form. There's stories on the internet of people bringing in wheelbarrows full of coins. I went to the bank. I got crisp $100 bills, exact change. I wanted to make the experience go as fast as possible.
Right. No, totally get it. But let me ask you this. Other than the experience, right, and you're an economist and this is up your alley, and I get that it was interesting for you and it's interesting for me too. But why is it important that it's so hard to give the Internal Revenue Service cash?
I've been doing a lot of research into how people pay. And, you know, I've come to one very strong conclusion that a cashless society has some disadvantages that we're not thinking about. You've probably noticed, especially since the show is from California, large increase in natural disasters. Mm-hmm. Electronic payments depend on electricity and communications working and being up. In the middle of a natural disaster, cash works. Electronic payments may or may not. But more importantly, there's a whole bunch of other reasons. There's a large number of people who are unbanked in our current system. The latest FDIC data show about 6 million households, not people, but households who have no connection to the formal banking system. And many of these people are working with cash. We are shifting to a cashless economy, and everyone is sort of, we're going pell-mell for this. And there are some advantages of cash that we're going to lose once we suddenly go to a pure cashless economy. So I'm advocating for a mixed-use society, both electronic means and for cash.
Without casting aspersions on what it is that you're trying to do, because I enjoy cash as much as the next guy, it does seem a fair bit quixotic, right? This experiment of yours?
A fair bit quixotic. A number of people have said it's ridiculous. Maybe I'm a little crazy and things like that. But let me just switch the topic just a little bit to records. 20 years ago, everyone sort of said, we don't want vinyl records anymore, Kai. And, you know, last year we sold $1.2 billion worth of records. So records have come back because people suddenly said, wait, we're missing something here when we go to the sort of the high-tech solution. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why if we eliminate cash from society, we're going to have some problems.
Jay Zagorski is a professor at Boston University. Professor, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Have a wonderful day, Kai.
Years of a really restrictive zero COVID policy that ended just a couple of months ago is still doing damage to the Chinese economy. Through January and February, Unemployment over there was 5.6% overall, 18% for people 16 to 24 years old. In normal times and in normal economies, where there are more workers than there are jobs, employers can be choosier. Not, however, if you are a manufacturer in the second biggest economy in the world. Marketplace's Jennifer Pack has that one from Shanghai.
It's lunchtime in Shanghai, and Zhang Xianfeng is at a restaurant near his work. Over the last two decades, he's dabbled as a movie extra, renovated homes, though most of his time was spent in factories. Now, he says, he's in construction.
I work 9 hours a day. I get paid $44 per day. My job is to carry materials like cement, glue, and ceramic tiles. It's better than a factory job because you don't have to do overtime. Anyway, it pays better.
He's not the only one who's left the factories. Last year, more than 80% of Chinese manufacturers were short hundreds or thousands of workers, according to a survey by consulting firm CIIC. Former factory worker Zhang Xianfeng says job candidates are wary of manufacturers.
A lot of factories deceive workers. They tell us the salary is $360 or $440 an hour. Then when we get to the factory, the real pay is lower. Or the work environment is horrible.
The work environment got tougher under China's zero COVID policy. Staff were made to eat and sleep at the factory. Last fall, a wave of infections hit central Zhengzhou City, where Apple supplier Foxconn manufactures most of the iPhones. Hunter, who only gave his English name for fear of reprisals, has worked there on and off over the past decade.
If you had a fever, your dorm would be sealed, and you didn't get food or medicine.
He says just as orders for iPhone 14s were rolling in, workers, fearing for their safety, were streaming out.
Foxconn recruited some new workers, promising them $440 an hour plus bonuses. Maybe the employment agencies or job ads weren't clear enough, but when the workers arrived, they found the terms had changed.
Anger and frustration, including at the endless number of COVID quarantines, drove Foxconn workers to protest. Social media videos showed they clashed with riot police. At the time, Foxconn blamed the payment stuff on a technical error. In a statement to Marketplace, Foxconn did not address specific allegations, but emphasized that the health and safety of employees was its priority, while it had to comply with the government's COVID protocols and keep production going. Worker Zhang Xianfeng says Foxconn is better than some other factories, but conditions can be worse when manufacturers hire through employment agencies. Worker advocacy groups say this method allows factories and big international brands to avoid liability for any possible labor violations. Employment agents like Jia Jing in Yunnan province admits there are some bad recruiters, but he also thinks workers have no loyalty.
A lot of workers like to hop from one factory to the next in search of better offers, but factories need stability or they'll never complete orders. My job is to help them.
He's traveled through Yunnan province searching for people to work in factories without much luck.
Some young people, especially those who graduated from an OK college, are too embarrassed to take a job that is labor-intensive or where the salary's too low.
Back at the restaurant, lunch break is almost over for former factory worker Zhang Xianfeng. I ask why he thinks it is that factories can't find workers when there are high levels of unemployment.
One main reason is that the workers just don't trust factory owners.
And he hopes he'll never have to take a job in a factory again. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Hey, what is this supposed recession we're going to experience?
That is kind of the question, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 100 points today, a third of 1%, 33,987. The NASDAQ jumped 34 points, about 0.3%, 12,157 there. The S&P 500 gained 13 points. Also, hey, look, a third of 1%, 4,151. The Treasury Department released its list of electric vehicles today that will still qualify for a federal $7,500 tax credit. Hint, that list is smaller than before. Shareholders from companies that make those vehicles on the now limited list did respond. General Motors drove up 1.9%. Tesla, 1.1%. Ford revved up 1.3%. Today it is tax season, as James Zagorski and I were just talking about, and as you are probably aware. Intuit, the parent company of TurboTax, dropped 0.4%. H&R Block was also down about 0.25%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note increased to 3.60%. You're listening to Marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. If you have heard it once the past couple of years, you have heard it a zillion times. Oh my goodness, the American consumer. How have they kept on buying stuff despite all the inflation and the higher interest rates? Well, it is possible that that string has played out. We did get very meh retail sales numbers on Friday, after all. And retailers are starting to cut staff, too. Not just corporate jobs, but actual sales staff. Walmart, Best Buy, Nordstrom. Today, David's Bridal became the latest. More than 9,000 people who work for that company are going to lose their jobs. Marketplace's Savannah Mars on retail for us today.
During the pandemic, retailers have had to adjust to a few sharp turns in consumer spending. And Wendy Liebman, CEO of WSL Strategic Retail, says these layoffs reflect yet another shift.
It's what we call the just-in-case stage of things.
Where even though the labor market is holding strong and inflation is trending downward,
people are just uncertain. And when consumers are uncertain, they just hold back and stick to what they must have, not what they might have.
With consumers starting to pull back on discretionary spending, Liebman says retailers are being cautious in turn. And many of the stores announcing staff cuts, like Walmart and Best Buy, have something in common, says Shannon Seary, an economist with Wells Fargo.
Those are definitely retailers that benefited from the work-from-home economy and from the stay-at-home economy, and I think we've seen a transition away from that.
She says we loaded up on so much furniture and electronics and clothing a few years ago that we just don't need as much now. Plus, retailers are adjusting to another pandemic sharp turn, the rise in online shopping.
We've seen the consumer migrate or accelerate their migration to digital.
Sonia Lipinski is managing director of retail at Alex Partners. With e-commerce booming, she says some retailers are laying off in-store staff they just don't need anymore. Others are taking a different approach to staffing.
We're in this world of, you know, the consumer is hard to predict. They're changing every day.
She says some are holding on to workers in this still tight labor market in case spending and in-store traffic tick back up and they need to pivot yet again. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
The This is a real blink and you're going to miss it kind of time right now in the world of generative AI. That's ChatGPT and the like. Things are just moving that fast. Elon Musk is launching his own alternative to ChatGPT not long after, it should be said, calling for a pause on more development of that particular technology. Congress and governments globally are scrambling to figure out how to regulate it. But interestingly enough, one area in which generative AI could have some real impact in this country is in how federal agencies make the rules and regulations by which this government runs. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
Federal agencies often ask the public to weigh in on how to implement new laws, which is great as long as it's a real human or group actually submitting feedback. So what happens when something like ChatGPT enters the mix? Mark Fabrizio is with George Washington University's Regulatory Studies Center.
It's not necessarily wrong for someone in the public to use AI to generate a public comment, especially if it's something that the person or the organization agrees with.
Fabrizio and others argue the technology could encourage more people to weigh in on policymaking, maybe those who don't speak English as a first language.
But there's also some potential concerns by regulators that agencies will receive a flood of comments that will take more time and more resources to process and to consider.
Agencies already use software to screen for comments submitted by bots, but ChatGPT could be prompted to make 500 human-sounding messages for or against a proposal. Dhiren Patel is president of DocketScope, a company that works with federal agencies to help analyze public comments. Another risk?
ChatGPT is used to make things up that look authoritative and require real analytical work to review and identify as being potentially not authoritative or not real.
He says existing software, plus the experts who end up reviewing comments, will likely be able to weed out bad actors trying to influence regulations and development. But agencies are still waiting to fully assess the impact of this new technology. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Savannah Marr was telling us just a little bit ago about layoffs in retail and what that's going to mean for this economy in the short and medium term future. But as spring turns to summer, seasonal businesses have started hiring, and recreational services, think camping and canoes, just for instance, those are popular summer jobs. So from the banks of the Wisconsin River, here is today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Scott Teuber. I own Wisconsin River Outings in Boscobel, Wisconsin. We provide multi-day canoe and kayak rentals for sandbar camping trips on the lower Wisconsin River. Staffing for Wisconsin River Outings always tends to work out in the end, but I'd like to believe that the work I put in during the off-season and leading into the season are what make that happen. In a perfect world, we need about 10 people to run the operation. I generally end up at about 7 or 8, and we make that work, but I'm always looking for those extra couple. If there's one thing I spend a lot of time on every winter, it's looking at our pricing. I'm not eager to raise prices, but at the same time, as a business owner, I have to realize this is also my retirement, and I have expenses to cover. Insurance has gone up. Fuel has gone up. The cost of maintaining my vehicles has gone up. What I pay staff has gone up. At that point, we have no choice but to look at how we're going to adjust to the costs and still come out with a profit in the end. When I started doing these trips and acquired the business in 2003, I joined a paddle sports association. And as I would ask the question, hey, what is this supposed recession we're going to experience? What should I be prepared for? What should I expect? And one of the individuals that I was talking to said, in general, people will continue to recreate even during a recession. And lucky enough, we provide something that checks off a few boxes. I always love when friends or families come off the river for the first time, and it's always great to see the smiles on their face. They're tired, they want a shower, but they can appreciate the experience they had. The fact that they were able to drive up on Saturday morning, potentially, and drive back on Sunday evening is what makes me on a Sunday evening when we're closing up shop say that this continues to be worth doing and looking forward to the next weekend.
Scott Teuber there, the proprietor of Wisconsin River Outings in Boscobel, Wisconsin. We cannot do this series without you, wherever you are, whatever you do. So do us a favor, would you let us know what's going on in your economy? You can do that at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, which is providing a good nudge to me to do that audit of our family streaming subscriptions I've been meaning to get to. I saw this in Variety today. It's data from the consulting firm Deloitte and its latest digital media trends summary. So get this. On average, Americans pay $48 a month for streaming subscriptions. $48 a month. Am I the only one who thinks that's a lot? Half of people surveyed, in fact, say that's too much. And about a third say they intend to reduce the number of subscriptions they have. A third plus me. That streaming thing is going to come as news to my kids, boy, I'll tell you what. All right, here's your moment of economic context, a little bit of economic wonkery to start your week. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York has some new data out on reservation wages, the lowest pay a worker would accept for taking a new job. It is now just shy of $76,000. That's up about $2,100 from the last survey in November. Our daily production team includes Livy Burdett, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giong, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, and Sean McHenry. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.